From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're waiting to hear this afternoon from President Obama, who will give a news conference before leaving on his last major trip abroad as president. He is sure to be asked about President-elect Donald Trump, who gave his first TV interview since the election last night. And he was asked by Leslie Stahl of CBS's 60 Minutes about immigration.
Are you really going to build a wall?
Yes.
They're talking about a fence in the Republican Congress. Would you accept a fence?
For certain areas, I would, but certain areas, the wall is more appropriate. I'm very good at this. It's called construction. But
so part wall,
fence
part
be,
fence?
Yeah, it could be some fencing.
NPR Politics editor Domenico Montanaro joins us now. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And let's start with what we just heard there. It seems like on a few issues, pretty important ones, that he's been talking about throughout the campaign, he's backing off just a little bit.
Yeah. I think when it comes to Obamacare, there's a little bit of that, too. Donald Trump was never seen as somebody who was ideologically rigid. He's pretty ideologically flexible, despite what he had said during the campaign. And I think it is really telling for us not to take him that literally. You know, I don't think that his supporters did. And I think that he understands that if he wants to make deals and get certain things done, he's going to have to deal with a Republican Congress that disagrees with building a complete wall along the border, which we've known all along. They think it's too expensive and not something that's realistic. He continued to say he would do that until the end and now says he won't.
He's also been talking about term limits for members of Congress, and they've said we're not going to do that either. Where might the Congress and Trump actually line up pretty well and want to get the same things done?
I think there's a lot that they can get done. I think when you look at Obamacare, the repeal, and trying to have some kind of fix to it in the Republican view, you know, whether or not it's maintaining a mandate, though, because that would balloon costs if you were to get rid of it. But I think that they're going to have to now own it and deal with it somehow. Maybe they try to do something when it comes to immigration reform. I doubt that they would do something on citizenship, but they were close to something on a path to legalization anyway in 2013. And it's certainly a lot easier when somebody from the opposite party of that ideological issue is able to kind of drive it home. I think, though, look at Paul Ryan's agenda. His tax cut you look at Donald Trump's tax cuts, but you look at Paul Ryan's overall agenda that he's been pushing. I think that's where the starting point is for a lot of what's going to happen.
Hmm. What do you make of the two choices that we already know for Trump's staff, Chief of Staff RNC Chair Reince Priebus, and the campaign CEO and conservative media firebrand Steve Bannon will be the chief strategist?
Well, as we're looking at what kinds of things we think that Congress will get done, the appointment of Reince Priebus to chief of staff to run the trains on time, to have that kind of relationship with someone like Paul Ryan. They're both from Wisconsin. They both know each other very well. It tells you that Trump is signaling he wants to work with this Congress. Bannon is still going to be something of an inspirational chief in the White House as he's been through the campaign. And I have to tell you, I've been surprised at how surprised some people are that Steve Bannon would be in the White House. People are, you know, some liberals are outraged because he's the former head of Breitbart News and has this kind of checkered history, financial troubles, a domestic abuse charge in the mid-1990s. But we dealt with all of that in August. You know, this is somebody who ran the Trump campaign, and it shouldn't be surprising at all that the person who ran the Trump campaign is the person who's going to be in the White House.
We've also heard Trump talk about draining the swamp, but then there are names being floated out there that look like they're CEOs and lobbyists to run certain branches of government. What do you think about that?
And I heard Trump address that over the weekend and saying that, you know, look, these are people who know the system very well. He doesn't really have the kind of team put in place or the kinds of connections. And now he's leaning on these folks. So, yeah, it's not draining the swamp. It's using the same people that would have set up probably any other Republican Congress and doing something that's more traditional.
I remember 8 years ago when President Obama thought about putting Tom Daschle in as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he ran into trouble. Do you think that any of Trump's selections are going to run into trouble and he may have to withdraw them?
Well, they could be very interesting once those hearings come up. If you were to put people like Mike Flynn, who's had a checkered history at the Pentagon, and I mean, if you looked at those Colin Powell hacked emails saying that he was fired because of intimidation and bullying. If you look at someone like Rudy Giuliani, who's got his own history,
right.
that stuff will come up and Democrats will bring it up pretty strongly.
That's Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Domenico, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, on the campaign trail, Donald Trump criticized military leadership and said he knew more about ISIS than the generals. On 60 Minutes last night, Leslie Stahl asked him if he still believes that.
I'll be honest with you, I probably do, because look at the job they've done. Okay, look at the job they've done. They haven't done the job. Now, maybe it's leadership, maybe it's something else. Who knows? All I can tell you is we're going to get rid of ISIS.
Well, maybe the something else is that it's very hard. The offensive to retake Mosul from ISIS is entering its second month. Mosul, the last major city held by ISIS in Iraq. Mike Giglio is a correspondent for BuzzFeed News. He's been on the front lines of the Mosul offensive and joins us by Skype from Istanbul. And Mike, your opinion, Donald Trump implies it's not going well. What's the sense on the ground? Is it that he's right or that it was thought it would be hard and incremental?
The sense has been from the Iraqi soldiers that I've been embedded with inside Mosul and with the U.S. soldiers who I've met on bases outside Mosul that the offensive is going well. It was designed to be slow. Taking territory slowly and methodically is part of the plan to ensure that ISIS doesn't return to the areas that they're taking and that they're secured, and also to try and minimize civilian casualties, which the slow pace helps with to a big extent.
We'll talk about that because as candidate, Donald Trump also said he would just bomb the hell out of them and also not tell people. He's been very critical of this idea that the Iraqi troops with the U.S. Forces aiding them have been talking about this, announcing that they're going to take Mosul. He's been very critical of that. Wasn't that because of the civilians?
That was because of the civilians, and I think the idea that you launch some kind of surprise attack in an offensive as complex as Mosul is maybe something that you might think from watching movies. But, you know, you had to build up forces, you had to make arrangements for the military aspect of this fight, so that there was never going to be some kind of surprise that this was even underway. And as far as the civilian casualties, you know, the Iraqi government says there's more than 1.5 million civilians in Mosul. That buildup really was to allow some space for people to leave if they could and also to prepare to leave when they can and to take shelter. It's a major part of the thinking of Iraqi and U.S. forces. And actually on Wednesday, as the election results were coming in, I was actually on a rooftop in Mosul with Iraqi military officers who were calling in U.S. airstrikes. And I watched as they actually on their own made decisions to cancel pretty urgently needed airstrikes because of concerns that there were civilians that would be harmed by the airstrikes. And I asked the commanders whether if U.S. rules as far as civilian casualties were loosened, whether they would then want, you know, more aggressive strikes, want to be less careful with civilian lives. And they said, absolutely not. From their perspective, they're even more careful, they said, than the U.S. is about civilian lives. I think one part of that is humanitarian concerns, but if we talk just from a regular strategic level, a military strategy level, the way that they win Mosul is going to play a large role into whether they can keep Mosul. The amount of destruction, the amount of civilian suffering that's inflicted along the way is really crucial to can they hold the city after ISIS is driven out of the city. And that's coming from Iraqi military planners and from soldiers on the ground, not the U.S.
Well, meanwhile, on the other side of that equation, the U.N. says ISIS has been killing scores of civilians in Mosul. Now, that's horrendous on its face, but also, you were just talking about strategy. That seems like a strategy that might backfire against ISIS. What are you seeing about those reports?
So I spent about the last week inside Mosul with Iraqi forces, and every day there's civilians leaving areas where there's fighting. And I was interviewing civilians as they came out. And they're, you know, very clear that ISIS has been attacking civilians. They're very nervous about being taken as human shields. They're reporting that has happened. There are casualties coming in from ISIS mortar bombs and other attacks when they lose a neighborhood. So as Iraqi forces are moving into neighborhoods, ISIS is fighting back, and they're a lot more indiscriminate than Iraqi forces. So a lot of civilians are hurt that way, and they're coming wounded. I saw a little boy injured with shrapnel in his chest from a mortar. And that's it's a very big problem. I think the twisted thing about this offensive, and I think ISIS understands this, and so do the Iraqi forces, is that no matter what happens to the civilians, a large part of that, fairly or not, is going to be put on the shoulders of the Iraqi government. And the more bloody, the more drawn out, the more destructive ISIS can make this fight, I think from ISIS's perspective, as well as the Iraqi government's, the better that is for ISIS's long-term strategy for being able to maybe regroup and come back either under the same name or in a different form down the line, and to make things more tenuous for the Iraqi government as they try to put control back over the city. And so that really is the reason that Iraqi forces are, at least so far, and I'm talking about the elite Iraqi forces who are in Mosul now, making a really big effort, and it's you can see it in a lot of different ways to limit where they can civilian casualties.
That's Mike Giglio, a correspondent for BuzzFeed News, putting himself on the front lines of the Mosul offensive. He's now in Istanbul speaking to us by Skype. Mike, thank you, and stay safe.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, Donald Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway told Fox News that Donald Trump would make good on his promise to repeal and replace Obamacare.
As you know, the House and Senate under Republican control, Chris, have repealed Obamacare dozens of times, but they've never had a Republican president to go the next step. I think Mr. Trump has made very clear what his health care plan would look like, and it would not look like the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare.
But last night on 60 Minutes, Trump said that his health care law would resemble parts of Obamacare. Here he is with Leslie Stahl.
Are you going to make sure that people with preconditions are still covered?
Yes, because it happens to be one of the strongest assets.
You're going to keep that?
Also, with the children living with their parents for an extended period, we're going to...
You're going to keep
very
that?
Very much try and keep that. Adds cost, but it's very much something we're going to try and keep.
And Donald Trump told the Wall Street Journal that it was his conversation with President Obama last week that convinced him to keep popular provisions in the law, like coverage of pre-existing conditions and allowing young adults to be on parents' plans. But is that financially feasible? And what should consumers do right now? Julie Rovner is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Robin.
And we're in the middle of an open enrollment period. Let's get to what people should do. We're hearing anecdotally that they're wondering if they should even sign up if it's going to be repealed. So if they want to, should they?
That's right. A lot of people are very concerned. I think the general feeling right now, and obviously nobody can guarantee what's going to happen, but the last time the Republicans, as Kellyanne Conway was talking about, attempted to repeal the health law, they had a transition year. Actually, I think it was a transition 2 years. So there's every expectation that people who are signing up now for 2017 will probably have that coverage for 2017, that if Congress does repeal this, it will be, first of all, it will take a little while, and second of all, they'll probably leave a transition period for whatever it is that they want to replace it with, because frankly, they haven't decided what they wanted to replace it with.
Right, right. And after the election, the Department of Health and Human Services said there was actually a spike in enrollment. 100,000 people signed up the day after Trump won, and a surge like that doesn't happen till the end. So obviously, people may be aware you will get it for a while and they're signing up.
That's right.
Yeah.
And yes, there was. It was ironic that there was this big surge in people signing up. And we're right at the beginning of the open enrollment period. It actually goes until the end of January.
Well, what about people who are covered and are desperately trying to use it before they lose it? We're hearing about this. Women rushing out to get IUDs, a form of birth control, while they can. What would you say to them? Should they, like, rush a surgery and do it right now?
Well, I wouldn't rush to do things that you don't absolutely need. It probably wouldn't be a terrible idea if you're thinking about getting an IUD to go out and get one. Although I should say that the preventive services, things like birth control and IUDs, will be one of the harder pieces of this to make go away. So because they can't do that as part of this budget process bill where they could try to repeal other big chunks of it. But, you know, it is hard to anticipate exactly what would happen. And certainly the birth control benefit is something that Republicans have tried to amend before in all these many votes that they've had to try to make all or parts of the health care law go away.
Well, but, you know, there are people, and I've been hearing anecdotally from some, who are panicking that they're going to lose their health care coverage and that they can't afford other coverage. So, as you said, it would take a long time just to untangle this. But, if there's a moment where it is repealed, do people just not have healthcare?
Well, one of the things that President-elect Trump said last night is that they would not repeal it without having the replacement ready. Mm-hmm. Now, that might also anticipate that we're going to repeal it and we're going to put a transition period in, so we're going to basically sunset it. At least Republicans are saying that they don't want people who currently who have gotten coverage under this law to not have any options. How they're going to fix that, including things like, you know, where he said, well, we're going to keep the ban on pre-existing right. conditions. Well, that's why you have to have things like the individual mandate. You can't just tell insurers that they have to sell to people who are sick. Otherwise, people will wait until they get sick to buy insurance. There has to be some way to make sure that there are enough healthy people to help pay for those sick people. They're going to have to figure out a way to do that. There's talk about putting people into high-risk pools. That was in the House Republican plan. It's now on the transition website. That has been tried in the past, and it hasn't really worked very well in the past. There was a transitional high-risk pool when the Affordable Care Act came into effect, and it ran out of money a year before it should have.
Yeah. Well, and let's underscore this, Julie, because the way Obamacare worked is the mandate that required that everyone have insurance so that that could pay for requiring insurance companies to cover people with pre-existing conditions or let young adults stay on their parents' plans. It sounds as if Donald Trump, maybe I shouldn't interpret it this way, but as he said, it was after his conversation with President Obama that he decided to keep these popular provisions. It sounds as if, is he just figuring that out?
Well, no, he'd actually said that before. He said it back in February in one of the debates. He has said several times. He's mentioned some of the more popular provisions of the law.
No, but I'm saying that you have to pay for it somehow.
Oh, I know. Well, yeah. Or have – it's not even necessarily pay for it, but you have to have some balance to make sure that it's affordable. The taxes that are in the law that the Republicans hate so much pay for the subsidies to help people afford their premiums. So that's one way of paying for it. But the idea of requiring people to have insurance, that's to help the insurers have enough money to cover the people who are sick, who previously they just excluded from the pool. So those people couldn't get insurance. It's a very difficult balance. It took, I should point out, it wasn't just the 4 years of implementation that it took to get the Affordable Care Act off the ground. There were 2 years of preparation leading right. up to the debate over the bill. Well before President Obama became president, there were lots of discussions and negotiations yes. going on with Congress and stakeholders. This was basically teed up and ready to go on Election Day of 2008. The Republicans don't have that ready.
Right. Julie Rovner, we will take this up again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, scientists are having a hard time agreeing on whether or not a chemical found in the weed killer used most commonly in the U.S. can cause cancer. The chemical is glyphosate, and the weed killer is known by its brand name, Roundup. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach explains why scientists disagree about the health risk posed by this blockbuster herbicide.
If you don't know glyphosate, you should know it's sprayed on farm fields across the country.
Especially in Midwest, where our cropping system is corn and soybean.
Amit Jala is a weed scientist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says almost all the corn and soybeans grown here are genetically modified to resist glyphosate, so it only kills the weeds. There's also resistant alfalfa, sugar beets, and cotton.
So, yeah, that's true. Right now, glyphosate is number one herbicide in Nebraska and also in several other states in the Midwest.
Glyphosate is not just in farm fields, though. It's in my garage. People use it on their lawns and gardens. I got this little spray bottle of Roundup at the garden store to take care of crabgrass in my flower beds, dandelions in the driveway, things like that. Glyphosate is like any pesticide. You don't let the kids handle it. You don't drink it. No one argues with that. The question is, if you use it according to the label, can it cause cancer? Recently, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency tackled that very question.
And they came to the conclusion that they have, again and again, that glyphosate should be classified as not likely to be a carcinogen to humans.
That's Donna Farmer, a toxicologist with Monsanto, the company that developed glyphosate as a herbicide in the 1970s. Clearly, Farmer has an interest here, but she's right. The EPA reviewed dozens of glyphosate studies and decided that it is not likely to cause cancer at the doses most people probably experience.
And they are consistently coming out with the same findings that the Canadian government did, the European Union did, the Japan government did.
New Zealand and Australia, too, she says. Regulators from the U.S. and all those other countries agree glyphosate is not likely to cause cancer. But last year, another group of scientists reached a different conclusion. IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, called glyphosate a probable carcinogen. Aaron Blair is the epidemiologist who chaired the IARC panel, which is part of the World Health Organization. Blair calls the difference between IARC and EPA a contradiction in flavor.
not likely to be a carcinogen means, of course, we think this is not likely to be a carcinogen, but, well, you know, maybe. So both of those evaluations, the EPA and the IARC, have an element of probability in them.
But why are they so far apart? It's largely a difference in design. IARC simply wants to know if cancer is possible, even at very high experimental doses. The EPA puts more emphasis on studies that evaluate the risk in real-world situations. That makes a difference. Also, IARC only looks at studies published in scientific journals. The idea is to avoid conflicts of interest. But Donna Farmer says it leaves out industry research conducted by Monsanto according to EPA guidelines.
All of the other agencies looked at all of the data. And again, I will tell you, IARC, in my opinion, by the way that they evaluated the data, created a hazard that no one else has identified.
IARC has given cancer ratings that raise eyebrows. The insecticide malathion is a probable carcinogen, like glyphosate. But so are red meat and wood smoke and hot drinks. Aaron Blair from the IARC Review says the point is to show scientists and regulators where more research is needed.
You would like to have a very clear determination the minute you look at things, but that rarely happens.
The EPA does want more research on glyphosate, particularly on different formulations, that is, different chemicals mixed in to make the Roundup more effective. They want to know if the combination has an effect that the chemicals don't have on their own. Aaron Blair says the riskiest exposure to glyphosate comes when people spray the chemical and get it on their skin. So simple precautions like wearing gloves and goggles and cleaning up are worthwhile, whether or not it's likely to cause cancer. For Here and Now, I'm Grant Gerlach.
While the stock market has been heading higher since the election, the bond market has been falling, losing $1 trillion in value in recent days. Investors are selling off bonds because they believe Donald Trump's presidency will lead to increased inflation and interest rates. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. She joins us from New York. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So let's start with what's happening in the bond market. A bond is a form of debt, but why are people fleeing bonds so quickly?
You know, why were bond rates, why were these interest rates so low for so long? Because we had very sluggish growth. And everybody was very concerned that unless the interest rates stayed low, either because of the Federal Reserve or because of market forces, the economy wouldn't pick up. Now we have a president-elect who's talking about something different. He's talking about infrastructure spending. He's talking about tax cuts, lighter regulatory touch, all of which could actually spur growth, but as you said, could also spur inflation. So this is being seen as this moment, this watershed, and we've had them before, so don't go crazy, where we see, the era of low interest rates is ending. We are about to enter a growth slash potentially reflationary mode. Bonds don't do so well in that environment. Sell the bonds.
So what should people do if they're listening to this and they have bonds in their portfolio? Should they get out?
They should not get out. And I'm going to turn on my old CFP hat for a second here, gang, okay? I know it is so much more fun to look at your stock positions last week rather than your bond positions. But that's what a diversified portfolio is supposed to do. It hasn't done it so often, but when one part zigs, the other part zags. And the one thing that's been very clear for almost every bond investor is that we were never going to stay in this environment forever. So you really got to stick to your game plan. If you've got longer dated bonds, 30-year bonds, you may want to move it to intermediate or shorter dated bonds. They do better in an interest rate, a rising interest rate environment. You also may want to stick to higher quality because that tends to do better. But please don't wholesale. Get out of the thing that's going down. You are buying shares at cheaper prices. That's great for your retirement account.
Meanwhile, oil falling to its lowest price in 3 months today. Crude is under $43 a barrel. What's happening there?
Well, what's happening there is that, boy, we sure do have a lot of supply. And when you start hearing a president-elect talking about opening up more drilling and perhaps bringing even more supply online, I think that that's a pretty big negative for the oil market that's already awash in oil. So you're right. We've got the lower oil prices. That will translate into some lower gas prices down the line. So that's probably good news for consumers. But again, If down the line we start to see inflation, one of the first places you're going to start to see inflation is in the commodities. So we'll keep an eye on that as well in the next year or so.
Jill, real quick here. We know that Steve Bannon, who's going to be the chief strategist for Trump, came from Goldman Sachs at one point in his career. It also looks like there's an ex-Goldman Sachs banker who may be the next Treasury Secretary. What happened to all the anger towards Wall Street?
Well, I think it's still there, but I think that when people realize that they have elected a president who basically is pretty much connected to the old school way of thinking around Wall Street, they may find it a little bit strange that this is going to happen. We saw financial sector stocks increasing by 11% last week.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
You've probably heard the news from the college sports world. Harvard University's men's soccer team's season abruptly canceled after news that since 2012, the team produced scouting reports and spreadsheets that rated members of the women's soccer team based on their sexual appeal. The Harvard Crimson first reported this last month, and since then, it's been reported that the Harvard men's cross-country team also has a similar spreadsheet. How widespread is this, and why is it happening? Let's ask Michael Kimmel, professor of sociology at Stony Brook University in New York and executive director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. One of them is hypermasculinity. Professor Michael, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And first, we should say Harvard is still investigating the spreadsheet put together by members of the men's cross-country team. So we'll await to see what happens there. But what was your reaction when you heard about the soccer team's season canceled and this spreadsheet revealed?
Well, my initial response when I heard of the spreadsheet and the ratings and all of that is basically, you know, a big sigh of disappointment that the athletes don't see their female teammates, as colleagues, but rather they see them, they have a kind of adversarial view of the relations between women and men, which I had thought was largely being surpassed on most college campuses. On the other hand, when Harvard's president, Drew Faust, actually acted so decisively to cancel the rest of the season, even though Harvard was leading in the Ivy League, even though they were going to go to the NCAA tournament, I thought, well, good for her, good for standing up for what's right, even in the face of, you know, the fact that it happens elsewhere, other people do it. You know, it sends a very strong message. Because, you know, when Harvard speaks, America's universities listen.
Well, that announcement sent the girls team, the girls soccer team, out a few days later to win the Ivies. I mean, they actually won. But before that, they expressed such sadness because, as you said, these are teammates, in effect. These men's and women's teams share facilities, share workout practice times, often share road trips. Yeah. Many of these young women have expressed that they actually thought of these men as, you know, siblings, as brothers.
Yeah, this is, I think, the heartbreaking revelation. And I think the letter that was written to the Crimson by the women who were first-year students in 2012, who were the ones who were rated, who graduated in 2016, you know, it's heartbreaking to realize that while you're working with someone as what you think of as an equal, they're really secretly treating you quite unequally behind closed doors. And I think that this is no different than the revelation that happens, for example, when women in the workplace find out that the guys are ranking the, you know, rating them, you know, in the same sort of way. You know, you think, but I thought you thought we were your colleagues. Right. I thought you treated us equally. How could you be doing this to us? And it's heartbreaking.
Well, quoting again from some of the response, Ruth Conniff, who's a former college runner, editor-in-chief of The Progressive, wrote about this before this event, and she said, one of the best things about the rise of women's sports is the friendship and camaraderie it engenders between boys and girls. Megan Cake Nelson was a former cross-country team member back in the early 90s, and she wrote in the Crimson about that sense of camaraderie and how they trained together, traveled together, how the girls cheered the men on as they ran their races. And then one day in 1993, some of the members of the men's cross-country team came to a practice wearing T-shirts that featured a list of the female runners' names, actually their initials, ranked by how many wanted a sexual act from the male athletes. You know, stunning. I mean, it's right there on their chests, you know, the men's chests for them to see. And here, a couple decades later, it gets even worse. Well, but how widespread do you think this is? Do you think this is part of the privilege of the elite campus of Harvard?
No, I think this is probably pretty widespread. I think also that it is probably on the decline in its sort of casual, unapologetic nature. So I don't think the guys would be coming to practice wearing T-shirts that said such things now, but they might do it, you know, in their own group chat.
Yeah, they might do it on a spreadsheet.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I do think it is part of, you know, what can you say, locker room talk, so to speak. On the other hand, I do think it's likely to be declining only because of the dramatic increase in girls and young women who are playing sports. This old notion that, you know, the girls were the cheerleaders and the boys played the sports has been completely eradicated by the dramatic success of Title IX in high schools and middle schools, where close to half of all girls are playing sports, whereas probably 40 years ago it was maybe 10%. So that's been one of the biggest changes in high schools as well as colleges. And I think that gradually women and men are seeing themselves as increasingly equal.
Well, but you have cases like two Texas A&M football coaches earlier this year suspended after organizing a women's football clinic that had a sexist version of the school's fight song and these faux instructions that were all, you know, filled with sexual innuendo. You had in 2013 Tufts University suspending 27 male lacrosse players for shouting sexist comments at women playing a volleyball game. Mm-hmm. So you have these incidents. And you mentioned the locker room talk. You have, on a national scale, you have the president-elect on tape talking with an entertainer, Billy Bush, about grabbing women's genitals.
Right.
You say it's declined, but is that an okay for it to, you know, what are you seeing culturally?
Well, you know, just because I think that in general it's on the decline does not mean we're going to continue to hear about all of these egregious examples that you're citing. But what you don't hear about are the coaches who say, you know what, on my watch, this will not happen. If any of you do any of this, you're off the team. Goodbye. Done. So I think, yes, of course, we have these egregious examples. And yes, of course, we have this this notion stated on a videotape that it's perfectly okay that locker room talk can even include confessions of actual sexual assault. So, yes, of course, we have this. And yes, of course, this is going to give people a sense of that permission. But here's what's missing. Okay. In that tape, we had something happening. We had Trump bragging to these guys about what he was able to do because of his celebrity. And their response to him was, oh, my God, you are just so awesome. I wish I could be you. I wish I could do that, too. Now, here's the part that's important. When some male players on some male team start to do this sort of thing, here's what's necessary. Some male players on that same team say, not okay.
Well, how do you get that to happen, Professor?
Well, again, I truly believe that that is happening. And that, in fact, those are the stories we never hear reported because nothing terrible happens. These kinds of things happen only because of other guys' silence, that other guys who feel uncomfortable with it kind of grudgingly go along because it's the guy thing to do. It's locker room talk. It'll never get out. You'll never get in trouble for it. And I think these guys are increasingly feeling that, you know, they're also feeling emboldened. They're also feeling, with all of the work in sexual assault on campuses, all of the bystander intervention projects that have been developed on every single campus in the country, that what you're seeing is that these guys are also feeling braver now to say, not okay with me. And that, I think, is going to be the thing that ends it ultimately.
Well, and Michael Kimmel, again, you are a professor of sociology. You're the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. So I want to ask you a question more broadly. You don't know the Harvard students at all, but why would a Harvard star soccer player even need to denigrate women? What is that missing there? That, I mean, you're at the peak of your college sport, presumably a big man on campus. Why would they even need to do this?
Well, because there's two reasons why. One, because they can. Because they feel entitled. There's also, you know, while on the one hand, these are some of the most talented, brilliant students that, you know, this country could possibly produce, and they feel quite entitled to do whatever they want. And secondly, because men often have experienced women's equality as somehow a zero-sum game, and that now that women's sports are getting equal funding and are, you know, recruiting just the same way, some of these guys still maintain a kind of adversarial idea of how women and men should behave. And the key word that you used before was siblings. That the more equal that students get on campuses, the more they see each other as brothers and sisters, and they do stand up for each other when they see each other that way. That's not adversarial. That is familial.
Michael Kimmel, professor of sociology at Stony Brook University in New York, executive director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. Professor, thank you.
Sure. Nice to be with you, Robin.
President-elect Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke by phone today. President Xi congratulated Trump for his victory and said cooperation between the world's two biggest economies is the only correct choice for the future. State media in China reported that Xi told Trump there is opportunity and potential in the relationship. But during the campaign, Trump blasted China and threatened huge tariffs on Chinese imports. Stephen Nagy is an associate professor of politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo. He's with us on Skype. Professor, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Great to be back.
And first of all, what do you make of this phone call between these two? Our reporter in Shanghai, Rob Schmidt, says that when Trump told the Wall Street Journal on Saturday that he had spoken to all the world's major leaders except Xi, that it was a high-level public shaming and that face had been lost. Is that your view?
No, not at all. I think right now the Chinese government and President Xi is trying to assess what is the short, mid, and long-term implications of a President Trump. Based on his rhetoric during the campaign with Hillary Clinton, he has a very acerbic point of view about China, a very protectionist view of point of China, quite an aggressive point of view about China as being the root of problems for the United States. So in that conversation, President Xi had to figure out, you know, what's the best way to approach President-elect Trump, gauge what kind of president he may be, and see if there's an ability for President Trump to follow really, you know, the past 40 years of American foreign policy vis-a-vis China in terms of engaging China, trying to bring it into international institutions, trying to see if it can socialize it in terms of dealing with the international system. So I'm not surprised by this. And the contrast is Prime Minister Abe, who has already set up a meeting with President-elect Trump, who's going to meet President-elect Trump on the 17th and spend some quality time with President Trump trying to figure out what is Trump's position on the Japan-U.S. Military alliance and going forward in East Asia.
But what does it tell you that President Xi waited so long to call President-elect Trump?
Again, I think it's really a lack of understanding of what President Trump's position is on China. Was the process of being elected just rhetoric, or was that his real feelings? Is President-elect Trump going to actually slap a 25% tariff on Chinese products? This would definitely affect the Chinese economy. It would affect the bilateral relations at the economic level, but it would probably enhance a security dilemma between these two countries, which is very worrisome, not only for the region, but for the United States and China as well.
How do you think China would react if the U.S. took a tougher line, let's say, on currency manipulation?
Well, I think there's a couple areas that they can move forward. One is to look to regional partners and try to cement regional trade agreements. One is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is RCEP. Basically, it's China, Japan, and Korea, plus the ASEAN states and a few others. This is a low-quality trade agreement, but it's in essence free trade for many countries in East Asia. The second potential approach is to push the Japan-China-Korea Free Trade Agreement. Again, these are agreements that are important for these countries, but I think important for the United States because they exclude the United States. It would mean that the United States are not part of the biggest trade agreements, the biggest free trade agreements that are going on at the moment. So these would be debilitating for the United States. They'd be a problem for the United States. And it means that the United States has less influence within the region. So China's approach is to look for how it can engage in economic relationships within the region, how it can expand its economic markets within the region. And one of those strategies is to use the One Belt, One Road. They can fund the One Belt, One Road with the Asian Infrastructure and Investment Bank. So China has a lot of options, but the United States also has some negotiating room as well.
But are Japan and Korea and other major countries in the region going to be open to that, to having closer ties with China, given everything else that's going on with the islands in the South China Sea and other disputes between the countries?
So this is an excellent question. I think what South Korea and Japan can do is that they can engage in a more deeper discussion, a more serious discussion with regards to the Japan-China-South Korea Free Trade Agreement or the RCEP Agreement to push the United States to get on board with the TPP or push the United States to get more engaged within the region. For South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, and many countries in Southeast Asia, they see the United States as being a very important player that secures those countries' security within the region, while they at the same time engage in economic relationships with China. So the idea is that they actively engage in economic relationships with China, but they hedge their bets by engaging in security cooperation with the United States.
That's Stephen Nagy, an associate professor of politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, as always.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.